It's Tuesday, September 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, President Obama visits Laos following his G20 meeting in China. President Obama and Vladimir Putin discuss Syria.
We insist that the conversation between Hong Kong civil society and Beijing has to be based on the mutual respect.
International Edition speaks with a winning candidate in Hong Kong. Also ahead, blurred lines in music piracy bring artists together. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. President Barack Obama is seeking to reassure nations in Southeast Asia that the United States is firmly committed to its rebalance to the region during his historic trip to Laos this week. Obama's arrival today marked the first time a sitting U.S. president has visited the country. He will be attending the Association of Southeast Asian Nations Summit and the East Asia Summit, where he will seek to further deepen ties and increase America's influence in the region. White House officials said Obama will seek to advance U.S.-Laos relations. Laos, which had been criticized for its human rights record, is currently the ASEAN chair. Phil Robertson, Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch Asia Division, says President Obama needs to address the issue during his visit.
President Obama should recognize that this is a human rights test. This is the first time a U.S. president has actually gone to Laos. And so it's important for him to make sure that he says the word Sombat Sompon, and he does raise the case with the Lao authorities, and that he also speaks out publicly.
Later, Mr. Obama will deliver a speech on his Asia policy and its impact during his presidency. He will credit his policy with increased commercial, economic, and security ties and for more partnerships in the region to deal with sensitive issues like maritime security. Chinese President Xi Jinping, who warned against the global economy, is at a crucial juncture, told leaders of the just-concluded G20 meeting in Hangzhou, China, that they should strive for an open economy that promotes trade and investment. Mr. Xi said the G20 should abide by its commitment to avoid taking on new protectionist measures, but rather increase investment and cooperation and practical measures to boost growth. The 11th G20 summit was held against the backdrop of sluggish demand, market volatility, and rising opposition to free trade agreements and globalization. Silvercrest Asset Management chief strategist and China expert Patrick Jovanic tells VOA's Victor Beattie that current trade imbalances have reached a point where they need to be corrected, and China, with its overcapacity in areas like cheap steel exports, must decide whether it wants to be part of the problem or the solution.
It is a big issue, and it's bad not just for the rest of the world, but it's bad for China as well. China's had this massive investment boom where they've built out a huge amount of overcapacity in a lot of industries that has generated demand for machinery and raw materials, but it's had a deflationary effect on a lot of other markets around the world. Steel is feeling the brunt of it right now, both in the United States and Europe, and the way that China deals with this or doesn't deal with it, it's going to cast a shadow over the global economy. But they need to fix it because it's in China's interest to fix it as well.
If free trade and globalization are the keys to global growth, why are we dealing with sluggish demand, financial market volatility, and feeble trade and investment?
I think at the root of it, you have two of the largest economies in the world, number two, China, and the fourth largest, Germany, whose entire growth model is predicated upon producing more than they consume. That was not a problem as long as the rest of the world was able and willing to consume more than they produced, but that's become a problem. And when the ability to do that, to go into greater and greater debt, to consume more than you produce, dries up, you're left with a global economy with too much supply and too little demand. So what needs to happen is the surplus countries, Germany and China, need to consume commensurate with their output. And that's in their interest to do so, and it's in the world's interest to do so. They could become growth drivers in a way that they haven't been up until this point, but it requires real rebalancing both within Europe and between China and the rest of the world.
Do you expect anything substantive to come out of the G20 meeting?
It's hard to say. Some of the most substantive things take some time to play out. Like, for instance, some people speculate that the most substantive thing to come out of the last G20 meeting was an agreement that China not radically devalue its currency. It's hard to say. Nobody actually confirmed that was an agreement, but a lot of people speculated it was, and if so, then it partially worked in the sense that China's currency drifted downwards, but it devalued significantly. So some of the more significant things that might come out of this meeting might not be in any press releases or headlines, but they might become evident over time.
Patrick Chovanec also suggests that China should support its currency and avoid any further devaluation. It's time for us now to check out what's buzzing online. And for that, our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee, joins me here in the studio. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
What do you have for us today?
The story that broke out this afternoon that's getting a lot of attention is a canceled bilateral meeting between President Barack Obama and his Filipino counterpart, Rodrigo Duterte. Mr. Obama was scheduled to have a meeting with Duterte on Wednesday, but changed the schedule after the Filipino president called him an insulting name. Many news outlets and reporters on the scene are tweeting about the development, with some adding that the last time Mr. Obama canceled a bilateral meeting was back in 2013 with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Well, was there any particular tweet on the subject?
There were a lot, but CNN Philippines tweeted, "Duterte, I am not beholden to Obama. My master is the Filipino people." That's quoting the Filipino president talking about his relationship with Mr. Obama. I also want to add that the news agency is not owned by Turner Broadcasting System, but is a local franchise of CNN.
Okay, well, let's move on to a lighter subject. Mm-hmm. What's the buzz about Labor Day weekend?
The popular hashtags are hashtag Labor Day, hashtag Labor Day weekend, and hashtag Labor Day 2016. I just want to remind our international listeners that since it's an American holiday, labor is spelled L-A-B-O-R without a U if you want to search for that hashtag. Tweets and Facebook posts using those hashtags are promoting special things to do for the long holiday and lamenting that today is the last day of the year to wear white jeans and dresses.
I don't know. I see people wearing them all year round, but it is the unofficial start of the fall season, although the equinox is not until later this month. Mm-hmm. What else happens to be trending?
Jim, we're going to end this segment on a high note. Giant pandas are now taken off the endangered species list. That's thanks to decades of conservation efforts by the Chinese government, so the WWF, National Geographic, and countless other media outlets are tweeting about the news. That's all for me today.
Well, thanks so much, G, for laboring throughout our Labor Day weekend holiday. You can tweet us your comments and questions to our Twitter stream. That's VOA at VOA underscore IE. And you'll find myself and G on Twitter as well at VOA Stevenson and at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia: explosions in Kabul kill 24 and wound more than 90. Philippine President Duterte tells Obama not to question him about killings. UN Security Council to discuss North Korea missile launches. Myanmar leader says Rakhine Commission will help heal wounds. Conservationists say giant pandas in China no longer endangered, but eastern gorillas are near extinction. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at the voanews.com website and on your smartphone at our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. U.S. President Barack Obama says he had productive talks with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin on Syria, but the two sides have yet to reach agreement on a ceasefire deal that would allow more humanitarian aid into the war-ravaged country. Obama spoke of gaps of trust when he addressed reporters at the close of the G20 summit in Hangzhou, China. President Obama said the two countries must continue working toward an agreement that would lead to a cessation of hostilities in Syria.
We have had some productive conversations about what a real cessation of hostilities would look like that would allow us both, the United States and Russia, to focus our attention on common enemies like ISIL and Nusra. Given the gaps of trust that exist, that's a tough negotiation.
Russia has backed Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in the conflict, but the United States is working with moderate opposition forces fighting Assad. Obama said the United States needs to see an agreement in principle from the Russians on reducing violence and erasing the humanitarian crisis.
The faster we can provide some relief to folks on the ground, the better off we're going to be. And that then is a predicate for us to be able to transition into a serious conversation about a political solution to this problem.
Mr. Obama noted that a previous ceasefire agreement had some temporary impact, but the Assad regime has since resumed bombing with impunity. Mr. Obama says he has instructed U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry to keep working with his Russian counterpart toward a ceasefire, and noted that Mr. Putin issued the same instruction to his foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. Russia's struggling economy, meanwhile, has sent millions into poverty as the Russian currency lost value and inflation soared. And as prices have gone up, more Russians are relying on gardening and traditional country homes to grow their own food. As VOA's Daniel Sheriff reports from Moscow, a food-sharing initiative is also gaining ground.
During Soviet food shortages, growing your own food at traditional Russian country homes, known as dachas, was a matter of survival. But with Russia's shrinking economy, even some modern families in Moscow are again relying on vegetables from grandma's garden.
Our grandma has a dacha where she grows lots of things like cabbage and beets. I'm cooking borscht right now, and I'm using our beets and carrots. The onions are ours, so we are saving on what we have grown in the summer. So that's why we don't feel it so badly.
For struggling families like Tatiana's, growing their own food is still not enough. Russian volunteers run a food sharing program to collect restaurant extras and distribute to those in need.
For my family, food sharing is very important. We spend now a lot less on food than before when we did not know about food sharing and did not use it. Now we hope that we'll get not only bread, but some other food as well.
For Tatiana's family, food donations have cut their grocery bills in half.
I think that food sharing has a big future and big prospects in Russia. The main thing is to inform the public about it so that people learn what it is and what is needed to be done. I think that many will join.
Meanwhile, Russians hope the economy recovers soon, so supplementing the high cost of food becomes less of a growing issue. Daniel Sheriff, VOA News, Moscow.
A new generation of lawmakers bent on preserving Hong Kong's autonomy against increasing interference from China gained important wins in the territory's parliamentary elections. Final results showed pro-democracy candidates won 30 of 70 seats in the Legislative Council. Among the winners in Sunday's Legislative Council elections was 23-year-old Nathan Law. He was one of the leaders of the 2014 protests, student-led pro-democracy umbrella revolution, which shut down key parts of Hong Kong for 79 days, demanding for full and free elections. Law and fellow protest leader Joshua Wong were convicted last month for their roles in leading the protests, but received light sentences. International Edition host Sarah Williams spoke with Law, who is the youngest person ever to be elected to the council, and he describes his reaction to his election victory.
Well, actually, it is quite surprised because I was originally thinking myself fighting for the last seat of the constituency, but turns out I became the second highest vote candidate. So I'm a bit surprised, but it also tells, oh, there would be more pressure and responsibility for me because more and more people supporting me and putting their trust on me. So I will try to enhance myself and try to perform the best.
Now, in this election, this was the highest turnout in any legislative elections since the handover when Britain returned control of Hong Kong to China in 1997. What do you think that says?
Well, it says that people are getting used to voice out with their votes. And they are really upset with the poor governance now. As you can see, like, this term of election, the voting rate is the highest, especially in Hong Kong Island. For me, I provide a new choice for all the voters, and they don't have more motivation to come out and vote. And the vote is also a symbol about of them, which they don't agree they don't like the current governance.
Some Hong Kong voters, were they worried about casting their ballots? Were there reports of harassment by perhaps pro-Beijing forces in Hong Kong?
Yeah, actually, I've been receiving a lot of information about there will be harassment from the pro-Beijing camp and also from the ones they hired. And actually, for me, during the whole election campaign, I got a lot of unreasonable delay. And for example, my date of mail is being blocked because of me talking about like self-determination. So these things are the ways the pro-Beijing camp use and the government use to lower your winning rates.
Well, going forward, and once you join the council, how do you and your colleagues, how will you move forward now as far as dealing with Beijing?
Yeah, for me and for Demo Sister, we insist that the conversation between Hong Kong civic society and Beijing has to be based on the mutual respect. And we could see that the Communist Party has no respect to Hong Kong civic society. So it is really unlikely that we will launch like dialogue with them on this basis. But once if there is signal about like, well, there will be mutual respect, then everything could start again.
Nathan Law, who has won election to Hong Kong's Legislative Council. Be sure to get more on the story by visiting our website, voanews.com, and follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. While you're online, stop by Facebook and see us at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. When is music original, and when does it cross the line as a copy of a previous work? It's a question that comes up surprisingly often, and it's being confronted in a high-profile case as VOA Top 20 host Ray McDonald joins us to explain.
Everybody get up.
Often in the music world, things aren't cleared. In fact, they're blurred.
Extremely blurred. Never more so than in the 2015 blurred lines ruling. You might remember last year, a jury ruled that Pharrell Williams and Robin Thicke were guilty of copyright infringement with their hit song Blurred Lines. They copied substantial portions of the 1977 Marvin Gaye hit Gotta Give It Up. And they would have to give the family of Marvin Gaye $5.3 million and 50% of the royalties from Blurred Lines. Mm-hmm. Now the musical community is rallying as Williams and Thicke appeal that. More than 200 musicians have filed a legal brief supporting Williams and Thicke. Some of those names include the members of Tool, Linkin Park, R. Kelly, Jennifer Hudson, film composer Hans Zimmer. They have all filed an amicus brief in court supporting the appeal. Many musicians have voiced concern over this ruling. The brief says, in part, that this ruling will punish songwriters whose compositions are inspired by prior works. And the brief says all musical compositions come from prior works. It will eliminate any meaningful standard for drawing the line between permissible inspiration and unlawful copying. That will stifle creativity and will impede the creative process. Essentially, it's going to have a chilling effect on songwriters going forward. Pharrell, Thicke, and T.I. filed the appeal last week. T.I. was found not liable in the original ruling. Jim, I think as long as music has existed, there have been squabbles between songwriters who say, well, you stole my music. The first one I can remember was back in the 1970s when George Harrison was accused of stealing He's So Fine for his song My Sweet Lord, and George settled. These lawsuits are extremely common. I think a lot of people in the musical community feel that this blurred lines ruling has set a very dangerous precedent, and the amicus brief specified that, in fact, there were very few appreciable similarities between Gotta Give It Up and Blurred Lines, at least in terms of the law.
There are only so many notes and chords that you can play. The combinations of those, you know, are going to sound a little bit familiar or close at times.
That's absolutely true. And in this age of sampling, it becomes an even more salient fact. Who is to say what constitutes a ripoff and what constitutes a salute or a tribute? And I think it was Oscar Wilde who said, mediocrity borrows, genius steals.
There you go. Well, our genius in the top 20 realm is our own Ray McDonald. You can find him each and every week right here on VOA 1 every Thursday. And also on Twitter.
At Ray on the Hits.
Ray, thanks so much.
You got it, Jim.
Listening to International Edition. You'll always find us at our website, voanews.com. Like us on Facebook at VOA Now, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Jim Harmon. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A quarter century of civil war, exacerbated by the rise of the violent Al-Shabaab terror group and cyclical droughts of historic proportions, has seen wave after wave of Somalis leaving their home country. Today, some 463,000 Somalis are living as refugees in camps in neighboring Kenya. In many respects, the conditions in Somalia have been steadily improving. The government and economy are taking shape. Somali security forces are emerging, and Al-Shabaab has steadily lost territory due to the combined actions of the Somali government, international partners, and the African Union Mission in Somalia, or AMISOM, forces. And thanks to the tripartite agreement of 2014, refugees have been making their way home from Kenya. However, the country, its people living in Somalia and abroad, as well as repatriating refugees, are still in dire need of humanitarian help. So the United States is stepping up, said Secretary of State John Kerry during his recent visit to Kenya. I am pleased to announce that the United States will be providing an additional $117 million more in support for refugees, returnees, and drought victims in the region, raising our total assistance just for this year to $265 million. And we will also contribute an additional $29 million to the UNHCR's new supplementary appeal in support of the safe and voluntary return of refugees to Somalia. This sum includes new humanitarian assistance of more than $87 million in food and non-food help for refugees and drought victims in Kenya and Somalia. Working through a number of humanitarian organizations, the United States will also provide aid and help improve conditions across Somalia, particularly in hard-to-reach areas of south-central Somalia. This aid includes support shelter, water sanitation, and hygiene, health, and nutrition, and livelihoods programs for returnees in accessible areas of return. The United States remains committed to helping address the serious humanitarian concerns in Somalia and continued protection and assistance for refugees in Kenya and elsewhere in the region. and continues to urge the international community to contribute more resources to humanitarian appeals to support durable solutions for Somali refugees.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.